right. Our sixth case for this morning is United States against Rickman.
Mark Stewart for Terrell Rickman, defendant. With the court's indulgence, I anticipate addressing the Fair Sentencing Act issue, which has changed in complexion, if you will, since the filing of briefing in this case.
A moving target, Mr. Stewart.
Briefly, a recap of some of the facts. On January 14th of 2009, the Peoria Police Department obtained a state search warrant executed on January 15th of that year, wherein it's alleged they found 18.9 grams of cocaine base or crack, and that Mr. Rickman, both at the apartment and later at the police station, allegedly made statements incriminating himself in terms of the possession and why he had that much crack cocaine. The defendant's motion for disclosure of the confidential informant's identity and also his motion to suppress were both denied. And on June 16th of 2010, he pled guilty without the benefit of a plea agreement. However, he reserved the right to appeal the denials of his motion to suppress and the motion regarding the confidential informant's identity.
So actually, technically, it's an oral conditional plea, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not just a flat-out plea or everything would be waived.
That's correct, Your Honor, although I'm not sure that anybody actually uses the word conditional plea in the colloquy, but it's clearly intent because the reservation of issues was filed, as I recall, by both the United States and the defendant. So it's clear that's the situation. On October 21st of 2010, Mr. Rickman was sentenced to the mandatory minimum of 120 months based on the quantity of crack and his prior felony conviction. The district court found, but for the mandatory minimum, his sentencing guideline range would have been 84 to 105 months, and opined that it was very unfortunate for Mr. Rickman and that a sentence of the mandatory minimum violates the court's basic understanding of fairness, and that, in fact, Judge Mim may well have sentenced Mr. Rickman to the low end of that range of 84 months, but for the mandatory minimum. Thus, the Fair Sentencing Act and, I would dare say, the Department of Justice commendable change are bringing to this court's attention its change of position regarding the Fair Sentencing Act. As this court knows, in particular because of several members of this panel, the Seventh Circuit has not only said in Bell that the Fair Sentencing Act, or if I may, the FSA, is not retroactive, but in Fisher said it's not retroactive for those crimes that were committed before August 3rd of 2010, even if the defendant is sentenced after that date.
So, Mr. Stewart, it seems to me one way or the other, whatever this court may do with this case or with any other case, that this issue, actually, I'm hoping, is on a fast track to the Supreme Court, since we have two circuits that have disagreed with Fisher. This court may or may, you know, we'll see what we do with Fisher, but it's obviously an issue of tremendous importance to a great number of people in the country.
Absolutely, and that's why, although ordinarily I would take sentencing issues toward the end because chronologically that's the way it unfolds.
It's unusual to have the government on your side.
As I indicated, the United States commendably, following the Attorney General's announcement that, in my words, not necessarily the Attorney General's, upon reconsideration, determined that the law requires application of the FSA mandatory minimums to defendants sentenced after August 3 of 2010.
So what do you think, if you had been writing this memo for the Attorney General, or for that matter for the Solicitor General or anyone else, what would have been your strongest argument for finding the 1 U.S.C. Section 109 not applicable?
I think in part it's the one they articulated, which is in a sense, along the lines of what the court in the First Circuit in Douglas said, and that is when we get to sentencing, the guidelines are one jaw of the process and mandatory minimums are the other.
The First Circuit used a different date than the Attorney General is using. But that argument doesn't hold up.
Notion being that by implication, Congress had to have meant, had to have intended that the Fair Sentencing Act be applicable for sentencings after the date of enactment, because otherwise there's a logical inconsistency to say.
Well, in the Booker world, I suppose it doesn't make any difference when the sentencing guidelines are amended, since they signal an interest for speed, but they don't necessarily need to be the same date. The statutory minimums are the statutory minimums.
Exactly, but there is, I submit, an inconsistency by saying, well, the guidelines ought to be amended, even though they're advisory, but at the same time, for at least 5 years from August 3rd of 2010, district courts ought to be imposing sentences under the pre-FSA mandatory minimums. The other part I submit, although I don't recall that it's addressed directly by the government here, is the issue that the dissent in the Fisher case on the petition for rehearing noted, and that is, in my words, when is a penalty incurred? That is an open question. Not many, if any, of the courts that I recall can think of have squarely addressed it at the appellate court level, and I think it's deserving of it as well. So in answer to your question, I think there would have been two prongs. One, congressional intent, and two, penalty incurred would take the FSA out from under the umbrella, if you will, of the savings statute.
Okay. Did you want to say anything further on your other points, or?
Yes.
Okay, sure.
Regarding the defendant's motion to disclose identity of the confidential informant, as may be clear from our briefing, it's difficult to separate that motion from the motion to suppress. At the risk of sounding flippant, and I certainly don't intend to do so, there's a bit of a chicken and an egg situation that I think trial counsel found himself in, and that is, had I known or had we known the identity of the informant, we would be in a better position to articulate a rationale or potential rationale as to, one, the merits or propriety of a Franks hearing, and or secondly, why the motion to suppress should have been granted.
That's, you're often going to have that kind of tension in these sorts of problems. And I guess, Mr. Stewart, it would be helpful to me if you could take on more directly the Wilburn and Harris cases, in which we've said, in essence, as long as you're using the confidential informant, as long as you're using the confidential informant only as a, quote, tipster to help support the search warrant, then it's very tough to require the government to disclose that identity.
It is, and Rickman acknowledges that. What's troubling here on that front is what I will characterize as government sleight of hand. This informant was not a mere tipster. He, in fact, had, we found out later, although for a long amount period of time, the government maintained he was just a tipster, that he allegedly made a controlled buy from Mr. Rickman.
But if they don't rely on it, though, why does that make a difference?
Because he's not a tipster. And
did they rely on it for relevant conduct, or did they just leave it entirely off the table?
No, it is not, as I recall, it is not, it was not considered in relevant conduct in the pre-sentence report, again, with the mandatory minimum, that would have been a bit of an academic consideration anyway, mm-hmm. but it was not. They also indicated that they did not intend to call him as a witness at trial.
So the controlled buy was not used for the search warrant, it was not used for the charging, it was not used at trial, it was not used at sentencing.
Well, what's troubling is that the government, I think, up into, and perhaps the prosecutor didn't know because the police didn't convey it. I'm not suggesting any sinister motivation here, but to say that this informant was a mere tipster when, in fact, he or she was not is troubling, especially because, or in light of, I submit, if one considers that the affidavit here, as I pointed out, looks as though it was a copy and paste job from the Johnson case. The informant in Rickman's case said he had been in the apartment at least three times in the last 30 days, most recently in the last 72 hours, and saw what appeared to be crack cocaine each time. Johnson, roughly 2 years earlier, that affidavit says the informant had been in the apartment at least three times in the last 30 days, most recently in the last 72 hours. Now, if we take the descriptions of the informant in Rickman's case against those of Johnson, it appears to be clear that those are two different people. Again, I'm not suggesting anything sinister, but it is not a stretch to believe that the odds of two different informants in two different cases, almost 2 years apart, would have the same three times in 30 days and the last 72 hours.
I'm not so sure. The police know what works, and they want to. There's an interest, would you agree, in kind of maximizing ambiguity about precise timing, largely in order to protect CIs. You want to keep it as vague as you can. You know that three times in 30 days and once in the last 72 hours is good enough. And you don't want to be more precise than that, so you don't want to let the suspect know who exactly it was who talked to the police.
If I may.
Please.
I don't disagree with that premise, Your Honor, at all. But what it smacks of is taking a probable cause or an affidavit off the shelf and just plugging in dates and saying, well, as long as we're close, you know, three times in the last 30 days, it smacks of craftsmanship or, as I said earlier, sleight of hand, when at the same time, you know, the informant had made a purchase and is not really a tipster. He's more than that. He or she is more than that. I acknowledge that he was not apparently going to be called as a witness and or was used in connection with sentencing. If I may, we ask that the court reverse the district court's denial of the motion to suppress and denial of the motion for disclosure of the informant's identity, and that you reconsider Fisher, not only reconsider it, but overrule it, and deem that the Fair Sentencing Act should be applied to those defendants sentenced in crack cocaine offenses after August 3rd of 2010. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Barker.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I'm Cam Barker, and I represent the United States. I would like to first address the sentencing issue, if I may. Defendant claims that the Fair Sentencing Act, or FSA, applied at his sentencing. The government agrees with that claim. We recognize, however, that the court rejected that claim in the Fisher case, and that case requires this panel to affirm defendant's sentence unless it is overruled by the court. The government supports this court's overruling of Fisher for the reasons stated in our filings, and we defer to the court on the best procedural vehicle through which that may be accomplished, whether that be this panel issuing an opinion simply applying Fisher and affirming the sentence, or whether that be this panel holding the case pending a petition for rehearing or reconsideration in bank of Fisher in another appropriate case.
So effectively, you're telling us that if we follow Fisher, we can be expecting a petition for rehearing from you. For rehearing in bank, I should say.
I believe that we would support reconsideration.
That's what I understood the letter to suggest, which is fine. That's a totally appropriate procedure.
And the government's position is that the 11th Circuit is right or the 1st Circuit is right?
The 11th Circuit's and the 1st Circuit's positions are not in disagreement, although there is, as you noted, Judge Sykes, a disagreement in the precise dates at issue there. The 11th Circuit's opinion is the government's position, Rojas. The 1st Circuit saw no need to resolve the applicability of the Fair Sentencing Act and sentencings between its enactment date on August 3rd and the date of the Sentencing Commission's effective emergency amendments. The First Circuit said all we need to decide in this case is that the Fair Sentencing Act applies after those emergency amendments, and explicitly left open that gap period, if you will. So the First Circuit does not disagree with the 11th Circuit, but the government's position is the 11th Circuit's reasoning.
But the First Circuit's decision did tie the rationale to the November date, which is when the amendments to the sentencing guidelines came into being. And the rationale, as I read the opinion, is that the implication of congressional intent can be determined as of that date because of the disconnect between the guidelines and the statute.
The First Circuit relied on that rationale as well as another textual hook in the Fair Sentencing Act, which is the statute's title. It's entitled An Act to Restore Fairness to Federal Cocaine Sentencing. And if I'll address both aspects. The title of the act reflects Congress's purpose to specifically focus on sentencings and to restore fairness to those sentencings. That's the reasoning of the First Circuit and Rojas, and the First Circuit relied on that reasoning as well in Douglas. In Douglas, the First Circuit also addressed the incongruity of having the pre-FSA statutory penalties apply while the amended guidelines range apply at sentencings. And we agree with that incongruity, but we believe that Section 8 of the Fair Sentencing Act reflects Congress's intent that the Commission have a clear fixed standard, statutory penal standard, to which to conform its amendments. The key here is that Section 8 allowed the Commission to issue emergency amendments at any time after the passage of the Fair Sentencing Act, and the November 1st date was just an outer bound. The Congress specifically required the Sentencing Commission to promulgate amendments as promptly as practicable. And so the Commission needed a clear standard to which to conform its amendments, and we believe that Congress's reference to applicable law in Section 8 of the Fair Sentencing Act refers to the Fair Sentencing Act's statutory penalties, necessarily implying that those penalties apply in future sentencings. So again, we on that basis and on the strength of the First and Eleventh Circuit's reasoning in Douglas and Fisher, we support this Court's reconsideration at an appropriate time and an appropriate case of the Fisher decision. But
the government doesn't take the position that this Court's decision in Bell was wrong. This is an argument, in other words, for partial retroactivity, not full retroactivity, which is fairly novel.
Well, the Bell case, Your Honor, it did involve a defendant who raised his claim in a pre-enactment sentencing. And so, yes, we agree that the Fair Sentencing Act does not undo past transactions, which is the typical understanding of retroactivity. We think there's different senses in which you could apply the term retroactivity to post-enactment sentencings. I think the title of the act confirms that Congress's focus was on sentencing specifically, and that application of the act's revised penalties to future sentencings wouldn't be retrospective in one sense of the term, and that it wouldn't upset any past transactions. But we do agree with this Court's decisions in Bell that the act is not retroactive. There's no necessary or clear intent overriding the saving statute as to past sentencings.
Well, there are quite a few statutes that actually just start taking effect the date of their effective date without undoing things in the past. So
That's true. There's the general presumption that a law is effective on its effective date, and indeed that reinforces our argument here.
And you'd agree that wherever we draw the line, there will be some people left out who are close to the line.
The people left out will be those with past sentencings. And some courts have recognized, the FSA was a compromise legislation in some respects, and there were competing interests. But those competing interests are simply not at play with respect to future sentencings. There's no need to bring defendants back from prison for a resentencing proceeding, and as with respect to future sentencings, and there's no need to unscramble past sentencing decisions with respect to future sentencings. So the people to whom the FSA's penalties do not apply are those as to which there's no necessary or clear implication in the statute. Yes, we agree with that. If the Court has any questions on defendants' pretrial issues, I'm happy to address those at this time. Otherwise, I release my time.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Stewart? I can't remember if you – did you run – if you ran out of time, I'll give you a minute if you had anything else. You don't need to take it. That's all right. All right. Thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not? We appreciate your assistance to the Court and to your client. And thanks to the government.